This is session number 4 of an interview with Harry Medlin for the University of Adelaide Oral History on the 21st of September 2007, interviewer Rob Lynn. Harry, your time in physics, as you said, wasn't limited by, but your outside interests and greater interests meant that you were more interested in the teaching rather than just the research. And that outside interest from the department, in fact, in terms of university life, meant that you were elected to the Senate Standing Committee in 1965. Now, how did you even come to be involved with the Senate yourself? What was your interest there?
I've always had an interest in politics and political activity. The process of that's probably it. The process of politics, rather than politics itself. So, through my increased activity in the union and the theatre, and as I saw the changing attitude to research, the changing attitude to funding, I was persuaded by somebody to run for election to the Standing Committee of the Senate. I'm not sure actually who did that. Anyway, I became a member of the Standing Committee of the Senate and was quite conscientious in my activities. The Senate had an explicit governing function, and indeed the university was described in its act as the Council and the Senate, the Council and the Senate.
Mm.
It was a bicameral safety device. It could not initiate legislation, but before any legislation, like in acts or statutes or regulations, went to the Parliament for approval, it had to have the approval of the Standing Committee. The Standing Committee could not amend it. It could decline to approve it, in which case it would go back to the Council. It happened on quite a number of occasions. I don't remember in detail what they were, but it was a little bit different from that. The warden of the Senate, the person in charge of the Senate Standing Committee, was the warden of the Senate, and the warden would be in close contact with the registrar and the vice chancellor, and have a pretty fair idea whether or not legislation was acceptable or likely to be acceptable to the Senate. It was as a result of that I got more interested in the core of the governing process itself, namely the council, and I ran for election to the council in the November 1967 elections. They were elections by the Senate to the council. The meetings of the Senate were held in the Bonython Hall. And there was no absentee voting. You had to be present in the hall at the time that the elections were held. You could, if you wished, you could absent yourself from the electing process. Just move to one side of the hall and not be part of the vote. The elections were secret ballot. And I think in that election, it was dead easy to be elected to the Standing Committee of the Senate. It was quite a lot more difficult to be elected to the Council. I don't remember how many there were, but I think there were about 8 who stood for that Council election in 1967. the order in which we were elected finally, and the votes were taken off and down into the basement and counted and reported back to the warden, the order in which the election of five people, and in those days the whole of the council was elected.
Yeah.
It was a great body, I think. Henry Baston, Dr. Winifred Wall,
oh, yes.
Harry Medlin, Jean Gilmore, the lawyer, and the last one, his name eludes me, he was headmaster of Adelaide Boys High School.
No, I can't.
Arch something. Right. Anyway, those five. Several were defeated, including the then Deputy Vice Chancellor. He was defeated, whatever his name was. he didn't like it either. In fact, I did a lot of campaigning, and Didi and I went right through the roll of graduates, and I brought out a letter which we sent to them all. We got about 600, I think, in the Bonython Hall. The moment the election was over, most of them left. I appealed to them to come. They came from all directions, people like Don Dunstan, John Bray, and Max Harris. Anyway, I got elected continuously, and the Act was changed. And finally, there were components, academic staff, general staff, students, and so on. So there were different electorates. I think the last time I was elected was a couple of years ago. Now, the council, the last council, I think, that was wholly elected was 1990. And I've got it on my site there, and I often send it round to show how the whole lot of them, the Chancellor, the Vice-Chancellor, every single person was elected. Now, there are about eight or nine who are elected, and the rest, the remaining 14, are either ex officio, selected, or appointed. So if you try any reform now, you won't get it through.
Harry, I'm wondering, before we go on to talk more about your time on council, could we talk a little about the origins of the Senate Standing Committee? Because you've mentioned that previously, and I think it's quite important we actually mention it again.
Yes. There were three early time revolutionaries: John Bray, Roma Mitchell, and Harry Wesley Smith. They argued for the setting up of the Senate.
Was it Sam Jacobs or?
Sam Jacobs.
Sam Jacobs, yeah. Not John Bray.
Yeah, that's right. Sam Jacobs, Roma Mitchell, and Harry. I often used to pull Roma's leg about what she was like. Yes, the. Which year was that?
1961.
Yeah. Yes. The core of their argument was that the Senate itself had become such a such an uncritical stamping device that it needed the legislation needed more careful investigation for the Senate to be effective. The warden was the chair. Yes, you're causing me to dredge the bottom of my brain.
From what you've said previously, Harry, I think Harry and Sam and Roma's concern was that the council were acting in an autocratic way into how they believed the Senate should function. And those three were looking for a more democratic approach to, I guess, university legislation, you'd call it. Would that be correct?
That is correct. I think I became a member of a member of a working party chaired by Warren Rogers, I think.
Yes, that could well be right, I think.
There were five of us now. Who were they?
Warren Rogers was warden of the Senate?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, he followed Frank Hambly. I think I'll have to take that on notice.
No, that's fine, Harry.
Yeah.
Well, let's come back to council then. And can you tell me what council was like when you were first elected to it? What was the structure of it and how was it run?
they were nice fellas. The council had started about 20 past two. They'd walk down, most of them, from the Adelaide Club. They'd all have lunch in the Adelaide Club. Sir Kenneth Wills was he was Chancellor. The head of the Engineering and Water Supply Department, Dryden, I think, was his name.
Mm.
The Master of Prince Alfred College. They were pretty much an Adelaide Club lot, except for.
Is that Jack Dunning, was it?
Yes, Dunning. Yeah, him. Yeah, there are others there whose name I. Eric Barnes was a member. The year before, the professor of economics had been elected. He's dead. Frank Hambly was inclined to be liberal. I said almost nothing until I think it was the August meeting of 68. I took a series of motions to Vic Edgelow, was registrar. I can still see him. Walked into the room, he was sitting at his desk. He didn't invite me to be seated. I stood up to attention in front of the company commander and handed him this series of five or six motions, notices of motion, one of which was that the student members of the University Council. We changed the composition from, that's right. There were five people elected every for 4 years, right? And the Adelaide Club had put out a voting slip. Don Simmons stood the year before me and got defeated. Don Simmons subsequently became state secretary. He's dead. He was a member of the general staff at the time. He stood. There were six. So he didn't have a hope in hell. They vote the ticket, and plumbing it's called, and they're in. So the year I ran, we knew that we had to have some rabbits. I can't tell you who the rabbits were, but try and randomise their vote. I broke the ticket. The ticket did have the two women on it, Wynne Ward and Jean Gilmore. The ticket had the deputy vice chancellor. Well, we ran him out. As I say, I came third of the five to be elected, and I wouldn't know who the rabbits were now, but I know I've got a copy of the letter that I sent around, and it invited people to how to vote, and then just to randomise their, because you had to vote for five, randomise the rest of it, and that worked. But it wouldn't have worked if there'd only been six. We needed rabbits. what was it like? So I took this notice of these motions to Vic, and I can still see him. And I told this story at his funeral. His funeral was held in the out on McGill Road there. He looked up and he said, "Harry, we live in a changing world." Well, anyway, I didn't even get seconded. God. But the changes came about when Ken Wilde, he was interesting. Mm. I was, during the war at Fort Largs, I was the intelligence officer at Fort Largs. He was the director of intelligence, Brigadier Sir Kent, who wasn't Sir then at the time, but Brigadier Kenneth Wills. And I got on very well with him. Mm. And I had to put taps on telephones, because on one occasion there were troops from Fort Largs on the Adelaide Railway Station who were talking about ship movements. Now, this came back, and so I got onto Wills about it. And there was a pretty important place, Fort Largs. I might have said to you before that it stood between the sea and Osborne. Mm. And Osborne was the gas company and the electricity company. Now, if they knocked them out, the city is gone. So it was quite an important place, and it was vital to have security. Anyway, I got Wills, so he knew me. Got him to authorise taps. I'm not too sure how it all happened, but I was the only one who could listen in. And I have written that it's quite important. In philosophy, they distinguish between doing words and winning words. You might know more about that than I do. Running and winning. And listening and hearing.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Oh, yes.
They're very different. They're not synonyms. They describe different functions. And I found that I could listen to people, even when they're talking to their wives and girlfriends, and just not know. And I've certainly written how important that is to listen but not hear. And reminds me of... Well, that advisor to Kennedy, who said that he'd been chased up by the American CIA because he'd used the word doctrinaire, and they interpreted it as Dr. Ware, and they couldn't find this. It's a bit like Hanif, isn't it? I'm digressing. What am I supposed to be?
You were talking about Ken Mitchell, Ken Wilkes. Ken Wills.
Yes. And he was a very good chancellor, I thought. And when he retired, he put in motion a series of reforms. And they involved amending the Act to include the students. There had been two students elected even before... Mm-hmm. Even before there were student places, but it was pretty rare. I know Wren Potts ran against a student once in a by-election. Well, they call him Tiger Potts. The student got annihilated. So in a close fight like that, they had no hope. But as I say, you needed rabbits to defeat the plumping system. So Ken Wills did a great job. I was then involved with the selecting of a new chancellor. And I actually convened meetings of members of the council, not council council meeting and reported back to them about my conversations with John Bray. It was very hard to convince him to allow his name to go forward, because he was a known homosexual. He was discreet, however. He had an elephantine memory. He had I thought he had a sufficient concern for the whole of the university. As it turned out, he was concerned more for the law school and the library. Fascinated with the library. It was very hard to get him interested in say physics or interested in the English department too. And when the Act was changed, I couldn't tell you the year in which the Act was changed to incorporate these reforms, but it would have been, let me see, 71, was it? About 71, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's still referred to as the University Act 1971. Whatever it's referred to anyway, that was the year. And they were revolutionary changes. There's a clause in there that allows council members to be excluded. Bankruptcy is one. I think insanity is another. And it's something like improper behaviour. I remember Theney Baddams when she got on the council. Do you know Theney?
I know who you mean.
Yeah.
From Woodlands.
Yeah. Theney Court. When Theney got on the council, she was imprudent enough to ask John Bray what this clause meant. And he said, well, I can't speak, Miss Baddams, as the Chief Justice of South Australia, but I give it as my personal opinion that conviction for the abominable crime of buggery might... oh, God! That's exactly what he said would fit you for this exclusion. I don't think she ever asked another question. Yeah.
So how did council function in those days of Wills and Bray, Harry? What was the format, for example?
Well, we used to meet in what is now the Edgelow Room. It's a stuffy place. You know, it's an oblong, oblong thing. And it followed the pattern of St Stephen's Hall. Now, the House of Commons still meets like that.
Mm. Yes, indeed.
With the two sides. And parliaments, even parliaments here, are inclined to follow the pattern, although it's a little bit different with the rounded ends. Well, when we... So, us rebels would sit on the to the left of the chair in the Edgelow Room, and you'd be confronted with all these Adelaide Club people. Although I must say, I got on quite well with Wynne Wall, to a lesser extent with Gene Gilmore. Gene was not nearly as smart as Wynne. Wynne was a beautiful woman.
Very. Very community-minded, service-oriented person, wasn't she?
Active in the graduates' union, was strongly supportive of the alumni association when I started that, and was very very helpful to me. Became very very deaf. I spoke at her funeral out at St Saviour's Church, I think. Yeah, I got a whole list of eulogies, 27 of them, I think. Yeah, I certainly got Wynn Moore's. So it was, in a sense, confrontational. Now, when we had built the new extensions, the Wills building, I was involved with Walter Crocker and Thiene and Roma were a bit involved in the decor, but not in the geometry. Walter and I were strongly of the opinion that the council room should resemble the peace chamber in Paris, where they negotiated the Vietnam thing, and the Security Council in the United Nations. Although we didn't have an entrance, but anyway, Walter and I designed that. The university architect, whose name I forget, was there taking notes all the time. And can you visualise the council?
I can see it easily, yes.
Yeah. And there were enough seats on the inner ring for the whole of the elected members of the council at that time. Council got a bit bigger and some of them used to have to sit in the visitors' wings. But it's now small enough for everybody to get. We had another attitude, and it was this, that the chair of the council, the chancellor, and the chief executive officer, and I think I got this from the United Nations, were to be diametrically opposite each other, not peeing in each other's pocket, which is what when Brown became vice chancellor. And if I chaired a meeting, he'd come and sit next to me and I'd shift the chair. I'd take it around the circle. But now, with von Dusser, there's the council secretary, and here's von Dusser. Here is the vice chancellor. Here's the council secretary. And
on either side of von Dusser.
Yeah. Now that's just not on. In fact, when we first got, talking about the Edgelow, what's now the Edgelow room, when we first got on there were a few of us, Russell and Barnes and Medlin, we used to go and sit between these people so they couldn't talk to each other.
Oh, this is Prof Russell?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Eric,
yeah.
Eric Russell, yeah.
I think so, yeah.
He dropped dead after playing badminton one day.
He did, that's right.
Yeah.
Or squash, was it?
Squash. Yeah.
Squash.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Eric Russell, Eric Barnes, Harry Medlin, I think there was another. And we used to be able to break them up. So it was mischief-making, but there was no need for that in the Security Council room. Anyway, as I say, Thiene and Roma did the decor.
Coming back to that earlier style of meeting, though, in what's now the Edgelow room,
yeah.
Harry, well, did you have a fixed agenda you work from? Or
yeah.
So it was set up in proper meeting procedure?
Oh, yes, it was. Mm. Yep. And you could give notices of motion. Like I say, I took that stuff to Vic and it got put on the agenda. It took us a while to get the thing fully reformed, and now it's gone backwards. But I was successful in having it resolved by the council that all supporting papers used had to be attached to the official copies of the minutes, because they were not. When we got on there, you'd get an agenda. There'd be papers that people would bring along and refer to and talk to, and you wouldn't know what was in it. And the minutes were pretty sparse. Vic, as I say, was the secretary, He'd circulate a draft copy of the minutes Monday morning. Councils were always Friday afternoon, 20 past two, so they could walk from the Adelaide Club, and he'd go home and do the minutes. And they were pretty sparse, but we got it altered. In fact, I had trouble with Mondusa because they'd gone back to being sparse, and I had trouble trying to get what I thought were essential arguments included in the debate. And I'm a bit surprised, chairman of the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, to be with Bray and Mitchell, essentially, if any member wanted something added to the minutes, and I can still hear John Bray saying, that's a fact, and it will be added. It's different now. They're edited, sanitised.
Yes, that's a more modern corporate way of approaching minute taking.
Yep, and you remind me that Ross Adler was always in favour of that sort of stuff. And I remember him saying on one occasion that the minutes are more thorough than those of any of the activities that I'm involved in. So, well, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. But Bill Scammell was good, Bray was good, Mitchell was good, Bill was good. Did you know Bill?
Oh, very well. Oh, very, very well, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a marvellous fella, for me.
Yeah, I think I said last time, you get in the lift with him and someone would get in and he'd say, I'm Bill Scammell, this is Harry Medlin.
Yeah, off he'd go.
Yeah.
He was a real tiger too, Bill. Yeah. So, Harry, the functioning of council, you said originally was in the Edgelow room, was very confrontational, but there would always have been, would there not, vigorous debate on issues?
No.
No?
Not initially. In fact, you might have seen that I've written the first meeting I attended started at 20 past two and finished at 10 past three. Bruce Macklin was one of them. I think I forgot to mention Bruce.
Yes.
Became Sir Bruce, I think, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. So, Harry, what were, to your memory, some of the big issues through the 60s and 70s that came up on council? Can you recall any?
Well, the 60s and 70s, yes, I can. There were these attempts at reform. As I say, I started in August of 68 and got nowhere. And it wasn't really until Ken Wills retired and Bray took over. I think Hambly probably chaired us for a few meetings. Now, Frank was pretty liberal-minded. Methodist, of course, but when Bray came along, it really changed. Roma Mitchell was on it when I first got on. Then she forgot to nominate one year, and missed a year, and she forgot that she missed a year because in her CV she said she'd been a member, but there was a big chop. I think the biggest thing by the early 70s, in 1972, I followed Don Stranks as president of the local staff association. It was affiliated with the Federation of Australian University Staff Associations. In my absence, John Keeler and Alex Castles put me onto the federal executive. There was a meeting held at Flinders University, a Fauser, as it was called, and it was it was really a confederation. You would know better than I do the difference between those two. Although it was called the Federation of Australian University Staff Associations, it was a confederation of legally independent activities. Well, I got put on the executive. Colin Wendell Smith. He's probably still in Tasmania. He was an Englishman. Very liberal-minded. I think moral rearmament, almost. The father, Kim Beazley. He was president. They had a shocking constitution. John Nyland was a member, central member of FAUSA. He became vice chancellor of New South Wales. Fine fella. I must take you into my bedroom before you go and show you a painting that they gave me when I finished as national president of FAUSA. I was in the Nyland's house. His wife's pretty active too, or was. I was in the Nyland's house looking at this thing. And you know, the falling rain, Zeus and the falling rain, all these...
No, I don't know that one.
Leader and the swan, and all these gods that fornicate with women in different guises. The falling rain. Well, this is falling apples. It's a great vulva if ever I've seen one. Anyway, so I standing alongside this thing in the Nyland's house and saw it, and so when I left, they presented me with a copy of it. Now, they had a shocking constitution, and I'd been a bit involved with the Theatre Guild rewriting the constitution, the union, and so I took it on myself to recast the constitution of FAUSA. And according to reports, I did it very well, and got it through an annual general meeting. And I tell you what, annual general meetings of FAUSA was something that... You had to be pretty skilled to survive. Oh, God. They could go for the essentials. Anyway, as a result of that, I was then elected to be president. And I became national president. I continued as a full-time physicist. I made arrangements with the department to let me free on Fridays so that I could go somewhere on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I would often come back Sunday night on the plane going through my lectures for the next, I tell you what, that was from 74 to 76. I wrote a paper, a case for an association of Australian universities. I was the co-editor of Vestes.
Yes.
Vestes was the journal of Journal of FAUSA, and the paper was published in Vestes. it was a proper, I think, scholarly paper, properly referenced, footnoted, and I got it accepted as the FAUSA policy that we needed a federation of Australian universities. They were supervised, the universities, by the Vice Chancellor's Committee. Now, one of the things A.P. Rowe did was to stir up the Vice-Chancellor's Committee, and in Rowe's book, If the Gown Fits, he comments very critically on the then inactivity of the Vice-Chancellor's Committee. The Vice-Chancellor's Committee was, and I don't know whether it still is, a private body created with a deposit of £2. So they're individual members.
Mm.
They're not a confederation of vice-chancellors at all. They could be bossed around by anybody. And in any case, the FAUSA and the Council of Adelaide University approved this paper of mine. They then convened a seminar here. Professor Provens was one of the deputy vice chancellors. Eric Barnes was the other, and Provens convened this working party to set up this symposium of Australian universities. Roma became acting chancellor. I've got the proceedings here somewhere of that function. There were, I think, some 150 people over one weekend, and it was put to them that the Council of the University of Adelaide had approved the proposal that should be a Federation of Australian Universities. we had vice-chancellors and chancellors from everywhere. I chaired the Bannon. John Bannon had just entered the cabinet here. And I chaired the meeting that Bannon spoke at. It was the head of that chemistry works in Victoria. A lot of people spoke in favour of it, but there was no resolution. Roma promised that Don Stranks was our vice chancellor. They promised that there'd be no resolutions and no committal, but it just died. There's no universities are now so vulnerable to the federal government. And I'll go on, Rob, by telling you how that came about. You talk about the Whitlam years. Mm. There were a number of good things that Whitlam did and a number of dangerous things that he did. You remember when he was elected, they had that two-person cabinet?
Yes.
He and Barnard, was it? Barnard, yeah.
Yes, I think it was Lance Barnard.
Lance Barnard. And they did all sorts of things, Whitlam and Barnard. Cool. I was still the president of FALSA, and they persuaded me to get the states to agree that universities would be Commonwealth funded, direct.
Yes.
And they would use Section 96
of the Constitution.
You know that section?
I do. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Stinks. It was clearly an enabling clause to allow the states to confederate into the federation. And as you know, we followed the North American Act and not the United States. That section allows the Commonwealth to make grants to the states under such conditions as the Parliament shall decide. Mm. Oh, cool. Well, look what this Julie Bishop is up to. Anyway, I went around. I, Harry Medlin, negotiated with Western Australia, South Australia and Victoria. Thompson from Victoria. Thompson was Minister of Education. He subsequently became Premier. Hugh in South Australia with Hugh Hudson, and I've just forgotten the name of the Western Australian, and we got agreement, and other people on the executive negotiated with Tasmania, Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland. The only trouble we had was with Joe Bjelke-Petersen.
Mm.
And Joe said, look, you'll live to regret this. And I've seen what Joe has said. Don Hopgood, once when he became a minister here, he's married to a cousin of mine who's died recently.
Yes.
Raylene. Anyway, he let me have what Joe had said. And Joe's right. So we negotiated it for universities. Now, ever since that time, they've abused the power. They do all sorts of things. I you might have read, I said I made a mistake in allowing them to take control of the universities. I'm not going to tell you here what Hugh Hudson said to me when I saw Hugh Hudson, and I took Sam Jacobs with me. He didn't want anything to do with universities, so he was prepared to... previously. all universities at that time, except the Australian National University, were answerable direct to the state
yep,
government.
That's right.
The funding came through the state government. Now, often they used to hang on to it, and I'm the one who had them just use it as a post office to come through to us quickly. Oh, you hang on to it for a couple of days, you can get a bit of interest. Well, anyway, the funding is now essentially direct. There are certain activities that are funded separately by the state, but essentially, it's Commonwealth funding and Commonwealth directing. Now, on the things they tell you, and universities, a great fraction of their time is spent in making up reports to different. Different areas of it's just ridiculous. Whereas previously, the annual report of the universities went to the state parliament and lay on the table for the days that Jesus was in the wilderness, 40 days or whatever, and they handled it. We also at that time got set up, an academic salaries tribunal. Now, there were two activities that were that had their own tribunal, apart from the remuneration tribunal, which still exists. Mm. The two activities, the airline pilots and universities. I led the first case before the Academic Salaries Tribunal in 1975. It reported in 1976, and we won our case. The case was defined for the sole university run by the Commonwealth, that was the ANU, and they were recommendations, equal recommendations for professors, readers, lecturers, senior lecturers in each of the states. Every one of the states honoured the recommendation of the Academic Salaries Tribunal. Another stupid thing that happened was after I left, they affiliated with the ACTU.
Yeah.
I had argued against it. There were always moves for that to happen. I had argued against it because I'd seen what happened in England, where the unions went into the general trade union and were buried in the millions of, and that's what's happening now. The peak council is the ACTU. So they're stuck with awards. The states don't necessarily, if you win an award, the states don't necessarily honour them, and they're not obliged. So there were two things that went absolutely horribly wrong with Whitlam. He abused Section 96, and Section 96 is now abused every single day of the week. In the funding of universities with the control that they have. And I just say again, look at all this stuff that this Julie Bishop comes out with from time to time. Sure. But Whitlam did one good thing, and I saw him interviewed fairly recently. What are you most proud of? He said, I'm most proud of the fact that I got rid of tuition fees at universities. Mm. Now, they were brought back. I'll jump a bit to Hawke.
Yep.
They were brought back by... It was Hawke's minister who then created all these... because what I negotiated applied to universities, did not apply to technical colleges, it did not apply to teacher training colleges. But they converted all of them into universities, so much so that this country has got twice the number of universities that it should have for the population of 20 million.
Mm.
the watershed, as I might have said before, is about a million for a decent university.
Mm-hmm.
We've got one too many in South Australia, and now we're getting Carnegie Mellon and other private things. Anyway, as I say, Whitlam did get rid of fees. Now, it was with Susan Ryan, I think was her name.
Yes, that's right.
She's the one who introduced the administrative charge.
Mm.
I've recently looked at a commemoration address that I gave here in 1987 when I was given a doctor of the university. And that day, there was a notice. In fact, I read the notice out from the advertiser about this administrative charge. Susan Ryan said, it's just an administrative charge. It's for administrative purposes. Well, it's become hex. It's become tiered hex. And it saddens me that it... I said, and I got the Adelaide University Council to oppose fees of any sort, and Don Stranz was very, very good, and so was Kevin Marshbanks.
Mm.
But since then, the vice-chancellors like Brown and O'Kane in particular, and the one we've got now, they just don't seem to care about the essentials. The other thing the Whitlam government did was, and just before they won that election, the minister, what's his name, Dawkins,
mm.
I was national president, got on the truck in Victoria Square, we had a big stop work meeting there, and I telling the plebs of the six academic freedoms, and Dawkins gets up and says, yes, I agree with everything Harry has said. Next thing, he's creating phony universities, and they're abolishing the academic freedoms. The first one to abolish was done by Whitlam and that two-man government. They abolished the freedom to develop. That just went. And development now is very much politically run.
So, Harry, through the 70s and that, particularly that Whitlam era, of, well, you have to say it was a time of ferment in Australian society, you had the bigger picture for the university. That's what I'm hearing you saying, that while you were very much involved in council at the university, you also had that wider role where all Australia was in your mind too.
Certainly did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a pity we weren't able to achieve it. I'd seen in the States, in particular at the University of Oregon, where that student of mine had the full chair of physics, seen the curious combination of central, of local, and of county governments and the mm-hmm. town hall. There used to be notices put up on the town hall. The vice chancellor will attend a meeting and answer for. Well, it. Strangely, it seems to work without their involving, you know, constitutional authority and I say these county things. I used to know how the county around California and Oregon worked. They get groups of universities that belong to a sort of fictional county, that not necessarily state. And that sort of divisiveness allows, curiously, I think, there's much more freedom in a lot of universities than there is here.
Mm.
So, I've been influenced by that, and I gave papers to the American Association of University Teachers, the Canadian Association of University Teachers. They're different. The Canadian one is a bit like the thing that I was mm. trying to get going here. The American Association has different chapters that cross state boundaries, and now I had a bigger picture, but it didn't work.